KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. In this hour, we talk to the head of FEMA about the agency's response to the catastrophic fires in Southern California. And the fires around Los Angeles have destroyed not only homes and businesses, but also places of worship. Faith leaders affected by the disaster give their perspective.
I find God in the response to those tragedies, in those folks who open their doors and say, I don't know you, but I'm going to support you. What can I do to help?
Plus, Meta debuted AI chatbots with human personas. Then things got a little weird. It's Sunday, January 12th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Fire crews in Southern California are scrambling to save more homes from the Palisades Fire, which officials say is already one of the most destructive natural disasters in Los Angeles history. Elise Hugh reports.
Ground and aerial firefighters worked to hold off the Palisades Fire from encroaching on the densely populated LA neighborhood of Brentwood and prevent it from reaching another major population center, the San Fernando Valley. For the first time since fires erupted on Tuesday, officials expanded evacuation warnings into Bel Air. At nearby UCLA, police told the university community to be ready to evacuate. The Palisades Fire is one of four major wildfires still burning in Los Angeles County. By Saturday night, the Palisades Fire alone burned more than 23,000 acres, destroying more than 5,000 structures. For NPR News, I'm Elise Hugh in Los Angeles.
President Biden had canceled a planned trip to Italy this weekend to monitor the fires. He's also promised federal help for hard-hit communities. NPR's Asma Khalid has more.
President Biden has been continuing to speak with local officials on the ground. Last week, when fires began erupting, he declared a major disaster declaration, which is something that allows the federal government to step in and provide help. And he's been insisting that the federal government is going to stick around in California for as long as it takes. This is all happening at a big moment of political change here in Washington.
NPR's Asma Khalid. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has sent the head of Israel's Foreign Intelligence Service to join negotiations for a ceasefire in the 15-month-long Gaza war. NPR's Jerome, the sign of progress comes amid sustained fighting on the ground.
Mossad chief David Barnea is heading to Qatar, where Israel and Hamas are talking through intermediaries. They're discussing the fate of the 98 remaining hostages. Israel says many are already dead. Hamas wants Israel to commit to ending the war, which Israel says it's not ready to do. In Gaza, the Israeli Air Force struck what it calls a Hamas command and control center located in a school building. Gaza's civil defense says civilians were sheltering there and that eight Palestinians were killed, including two women and two children. Here in Israel, mourners are gathering for the funerals of four soldiers. The military says they were killed when their armored vehicle came under attack in northern Gaza. Jerome Sokolovsky, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Top European and Middle Eastern diplomats are in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia today to meet with the new foreign minister of Syria. It's the first such meeting since rebels ousted President Bashar al-Assad. The new rulers want the lifting of sanctions against Syria imposed over the Assad's government brutal crackdown on dissent. This is NPR News. In South Korea, the first hearing in the impeachment trial of President Yoon Suk-yeol is scheduled for Tuesday. His lawyer says he won't be there. Yoon has been in his residence where his security detail has blocked police from arresting him on criminal charges of insurrection for his brief declaration of martial law last month. Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai is urging Muslim leaders not to legitimize the Taliban government in Afghanistan, because it restricts education for girls and women. She spoke in Islamabad today at a summit on education in Islamic countries. She said in Afghanistan, an entire generation of girls will be robbed of its future.
Under their system of gender apartheid, the Taliban are punishing women and girls who dare to break their obscure laws by beating them up, detaining them, and harming them. Simply put, the Taliban do not see women as human beings.
When Yousafzai was 15, she was shot by the Taliban in Pakistan for advocating for education for girls. She survived and was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her work in 2014. Special Counsel Jack Smith has resigned from the Department of Justice. In a court filing yesterday, Smith said he stepped down Friday. Smith had led the federal cases against Donald Trump that the former president tried to overturn his defeat in 2020 and had mishandled classified documents. Neither case went to trial. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. We start this hour again in Los Angeles, where wildfires have been burning for 5 days and are still largely uncontained. They've destroyed hundreds of homes and put more than 150,000 residents under evacuation orders. At least 16 deaths are being investigated. On Wednesday, President Biden declared a major disaster in the area, opening up funding from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell joins us now. Good to have you.
Good morning, Aisha.
Administrator, you've seen a lot of disasters. What stands out about this one?
You know, I think when I look at all of the different things that I've responded to during my time here, you know, when you come to one of these fires, it's people have lost everything. When you look at a hurricane and a tornado, people have something that they can come sift through and try to find their memories. But here they've lost the physical structure, but they've also lost so many of their memories, which makes this journey that they're going to have to go through that much more difficult in the coming weeks and months.
What sort of financial assistance is FEMA offering people who've lost their properties and possessions?
So FEMA has a program called Individual Assistance, and it's designed to jumpstart the individual, the family's recovery process. If they haven't registered already, they should register for assistance, and they can go to disasterassistance.gov. And what they need to do, though, too, is contact their insurance company, because while our programs jumpstart the recovery process, we're not going to rebuild their home for them. So the insurance company is the biggest piece that may help with that. And then if they still have needs, we're going to work with our other partners like the Small Business Administration or our philanthropic and our nonprofit partners to help each of these families as they're trying to figure out what they're going to have to do next.
And do you know how many people have applied for FEMA assistance so far?
Yeah, the number I had this morning, Aisha, is over 24,000 have applied already, but we know that that number is going to continue to rise.
And you talked about people trying to go to their insurance companies, but we know that a lot of people may not have insurance policies that covered fires or their issues with that. Is there anything that FEMA can do about that?
There's nothing that we can do as far as requiring the insurance company to stay in. What we want to be able to do is, you know, work with these communities as they rebuild and rebuild them in a way that makes them more resilient to future disasters. So the insurance industry wants to stay there. But I think I just want to emphasize, we need people to still go to their insurance company and get something that shows that they haven't, they're either underinsured or uninsured. So then they are, it opens up their ability to access the other programs. And so it's a really important step to still reach out to them.
And what about people who've evacuated but can't stay with friends or family? Are there temporary shelters?
So there are a number of shelters around the area, but one of the programs that FEMA also has is we can reimburse them if they've been staying in a hotel. So if you've stayed in a hotel, keep your receipts, register for that assistance, and then we can help them get reimbursed for the costs that they've had in these initial days of just trying to stay safe and stay out of harm's way.
And FEMA money also goes to local governments for recovery efforts. What's the top priority there right now?
For the rebuilding, the first thing that we're going to have to do is remove all of the damaged debris, right? All of the structures that have been destroyed. And so before we can start rebuilding roads and rebuilding homes, rebuilding businesses, we have to get that debris out of the way. And so that's one of the big steps that needs to start, which is why President Biden gave 100% of cost reimbursement to California for debris removal, as well as covering all of their emergency costs that they've had during the response to this. And then we're going to work with the state of California with what their priorities are to help them in their recovery process.
President-elect Donald Trump is claiming FEMA doesn't have enough money to respond to these fires. Is that true?
That is absolutely false. You know, we had bipartisan support with the supplemental, and we got an additional $27 billion to support the response and the recovery from these fires, as well as the ongoing recovery that we're doing in North Carolina and Georgia and Florida from Hurricanes Helene and Milton.
That's FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Aisha.
Around 24 million Americans are buying health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. That's double the number of people that were enrolled just 4 years ago. And some of the biggest increases in signups came from states that voted for Donald Trump last fall, including Florida, Texas, and Georgia, even though Trump has criticized Obamacare in the past. Katie Roters-Turner is the executive director of the Family Health Care Foundation in Tampa, Florida, an organization of so-called navigators that help people sign up for health insurance. And she joins us now to talk about what she's seeing in her community and what it might say about these national trends. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So now it is a navigator's job to help people, I guess, navigate the Obamacare system to find a health care plan, right? Like, so what does that actually entail?
So that is exactly it. That's our job. So we help people look at all of their options for affordable coverage. We then help them understand how to apply for coverage, look at their financial assistance options, compare plans side by side, help them understand what those are, and then help them enroll.
So how long have you been doing this?
So I've been doing this actually since the health insurance marketplace opened up in 2013.
And do you guys cost money?
Completely free. So we're grant funded. We're part of a larger statewide consortium through the Covering Florida Network, which is funded through University of South Florida College of Public Health.
So in Tampa, has your organization seen the same increase in enrollments that's been taking place nationally? And when did that start?
Absolutely. So we've definitely seen an increase in marketplace enrollments since people have lost their Medicaid coverage. During COVID-19, there was a pause to Medicaid renewals, and so a lot of people didn't necessarily have to prove eligibility. That was put on pause so that people kept their health insurance. But once COVID ended, starting in April 2023, everyone did have to start renewing their Medicaid coverage, and that happened for about over the course of a year. And so here in Florida, we had over 1.5 million people lose Medicaid coverage. And so we've now seen a lot of those same people looking at the health insurance marketplace and seeing that they qualified for help paying for health insurance.
Now, I also heard about that there are some new subsidies from President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act that for lower income people, you can get coverage for as low as $10 a month. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. That is true. So there's been increased subsidies now, which are great. Unfortunately, they are set to expire at the end of 2025. But still through this year, for people who have enrolled on the health insurance marketplace for 2025, they will be able to get access to those enhanced subsidies.
You mentioned that the additional subsidies for the insurance markets are set to end at the end of 2025. Some conservative Republicans in Congress are saying they caused the cost of health insurance premiums to rise across the board. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I would say that we have seen even prior to the enhanced subsidies, we'd seen the cost of health insurance rising. I don't believe that it's the enhanced subsidies themselves.
Obviously, President-elect Trump will be in office, and during his first term, he definitely talked about trying to make some cuts and things of that nature. Tell me a bit about what happened during the first Trump administration, just both in terms of insurance options that customers saw and funding for navigators like you.
Absolutely. So during that period of time, we did see an increase in the promotion of short-term health insurance plans. These are insurance products that do not meet the standards of the Affordable Care Act. They're not as heavily regulated. They can discriminate against people who have pre-existing conditions. And then there was a major cut to the Navigator funding as well. I believe it was about an 80% reduction.
I guess for an organization like yours, are there any preparations being made for the second Trump term? Is your organization making any preparations for that?
So for the Family Healthcare Foundation, we want to ensure, of course, that we are able to continue our mission of ensuring everyone has access to affordable healthcare coverage. And we have been working really closely with all of our supportive funders. And I believe that no matter what happens in the future, we're going to be able to maintain our mission.
That's Katie Roters Turner. She's the executive director for the Family Healthcare Foundation in Tampa, Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member stations.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Firefighters in Southern California are struggling to contain several major wildfires before more strong winds are forecast to return to the region. Tens of thousands of people in Los Angeles County are under evacuation orders. The French territory of Mayotte is preparing for another major storm, which could bring heavy rains and strong winds. It was hit by a cyclone last month, which destroyed entire neighborhoods and villages. And an emergency task force arrived today at the scene of a growing oil spill in southern Russia. Two tankers damaged in a storm in the Kerch Strait began leaking oil on December 15th. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at au.org/NPR. From American Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. It's been almost 3 years since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The children of Ukraine may not be on the front lines, but the war is affecting the way they see their world, learn, read, and play. NPR's Hanna Polomarenko reports from Kyiv on how the war has shaped children's lives.
Який дядя?
Тата. Аліна Дземко, who is 29, is in the living room with her four-year-old son, Yurchik. He is lively, smiling boy with big brown eyes, sitting on his mother's lap. They flip through a book. This is not a book of fairy tales. Its title says, Why Isn't Dad at Home? Odzemko is training to become a psychologist, but she wrote this book for Yurchik and about Yurchik. The book's chapters are about his real-life questions, which Odzemko answers in the simplest possible language. What is war? Who attacked us? Why did they attack? Who is defending us? What is army? Why does Dad not leave at home? Are some of the questions. Odzemko has already sold 1,000 copies. This is just one of many new children's books about war published since Russia's full-scale invasion. This is Patron the dog, a popular character in children's comics, voiced by actor Mykhailo Karpany for a cartoon. Patron is a dog who works in rescue service, and his main job is sniffing out bombs. He teaches children how to behave in mined areas and how to handle explosive objects, Karpany explains. In the cartoon, Patron fights the villains called booms, who are a simplified representation of explosions. The cartoon screenwriter Sasha Rubin says, you have to tell children about very, very scary things that cause really big damage and death without traumatizing them. Patron the dog lives not only on the screen and in books, but on the shelves of toy stores. This is one of Kyiv's biggest toy stores. There are long aisles with colorful doll boxes and cute fluffy stuffed animals right next to toy tanks, toy drones, and models of cars used by the Ukrainian military on the front line. Victoria Kucheruk, a shop assistant, says that demand for military-themed toys has dropped compared with the beginning of the full-scale invasion. She says parents are now doing their best to distract their children from the reality of war. However, many kids ask for military-themed toys. In their letters to St. Nicholas, as Santa is known here, she says the wish lists include tanks on remote control and models of military cars. But even children who don't have such toys play games that reflect the war. Parents and teachers from different parts of the country talk about children playing air raid, a version of hide and seek, or building make-believe checkpoints. Grandmother Larissa is from the Eastern Donetsk region, which has been hardest hit by fighting. She evacuated to Dnipro with her relatives, including her six-year-old grandson Artem. They asked us not to use their last name for security reasons. Part of the family still lives in Russian-occupied territory. Playing with our grandson has changed a lot during the war, Larissa says, as Artem and his playmates are constantly making up games based on missile attacks. Either the house collapses in the game, or he builds something with block and then there is a missile attack and we have to rescue children from the rubble. And recently, Larissa says, he invented a new game to hide from a nuclear attack. Odzemko, as a psychologist says, playing games that reference the war is quite normal for children. Children can't reflect on their experience the way adults can because of their age. Instead, children live by role-playing and games. While we talk, Yurchik plays with a toy drone and a couple of tanks. Odzemko is preparing to write another book about the hardest reality of war. On June 7th, her husband and Yurchik's father was killed at the front. The title of her new book is Why Did Dad Die? This is a question that many children will keep asking as the war in Ukraine continues. Hanna Polomarenko, NPR News, Kyiv.
Just this past week, the United States Capitol Police stopped a man from bringing a machete and knives past a screening checkpoint and responded to a man who tried to set a vehicle on fire outside the Capitol. The back-to-back incidents come amid heightened security ahead of President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration. Threats against lawmakers have grown exponentially in recent years. NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt brings us this report.
Last month, Congressman Tim Burchett was out to dinner when he got a call from local police about a threat of a pipe bomb in his mailbox.
I wasn't at the house at the time, and I was concerned because my daughter was. She's 17. She's a barrel racer, so she's a tough little cowgirl, but it was an unfortunate situation, and they locked the street down and evacuated the houses. The FBI came out.
The Tennessee Republican was the target of two swatting incidents last year, a crime where someone makes a false report, like a bomb threat, aimed at generating a huge law enforcement response that can be volatile, frightening, and dangerous, both for the people at home and the police.
It does exactly what the dirtbags want. It disrupts your life and has real consequences, and somebody's going to get killed.
And in a swatting threat against Georgia Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, that's exactly what happened.
Someone sent an email to our city police and said that there was a pipe bomb in my mailbox. Well, they, of course, responded to that threat. And tragically, there was a car accident, and a 66-year-old woman ended up dying at the hospital after the car accident. These are the results of these swattings, pranks.
At the end of last year, there were at least 50 swatting calls made in 1 month targeting members of Congress. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut was one of them.
My sense is that it came from outside of the United States. We live in a world in which somebody in a basement in Moscow can cause the police to be rallied to any school, any business, or any house in the United States.
Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger said the nature of swatting makes it incredibly challenging to track the source.
There are apps that anonymize the individual who's, I mean, that's how they market themselves, you know, that you can send an email and nobody will ever find out. Oftentimes, we find out that these are coming through servers from another country, and whether they originated in the other country or it originated here, it's very, very difficult. I'm not saying impossible, but it's very, very difficult.
He says the FBI has made some progress on these cases.
But it's still a tactic where people seem to be able to do it and get away with it, unfortunately.
Manger said it's likely a small number of people making a large volume of threats, and that the rise in swatting aligns with the increase of other threats.
For many years, if we got 1,000 or 2,000 threats, you know, throughout the year, that was about average. Now we're averaging 8,000 to 9,000 every year. It's really shot through the roof.
He told the Senate the force needs more staff.
When I look at the number of threat investigative agents and the number of analysts that we have, I need more of each because of the sheer numbers. And believe me, I understand when people, you know, hear that the government wants more people and all that sort of thing, and they sort of roll their eyes. But all you have to do is look at the caseload that we have.
As for Burchett, he says he's already put over $40,000 into securing his 60-acre farm in Tennessee, and that the growing threats against lawmakers more broadly has an effect on who actually wants to run for Congress.
People want to make their families endure this stuff, and there's stuff that's going on around me that I can't even talk about because it's ongoing, but it's real. And I'd say a lot of people don't want to do it.
Congress has taken steps to help members pay for some personal security measures, but it's just one part of addressing growing safety concerns for lawmakers in D.C. and back at home. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, The Capitol.
A mass for victims and first responders of the Los Angeles wildfires took place at the Cathedral of Our Lady of the Angels last week.
Lord, every nation.
Houses of worship have become important touchstones in communities ravaged by disaster. Joining me from LA to talk about some sacred spaces that were destroyed in the fires is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning.
So what do we know about the scope of the destruction when it comes to churches and synagogues and other places of worship?
Well, Aisha, it's hard to say exactly, given that the fires are still burning in many places around LA, and many congregations still haven't been able to get near enough to their buildings to really take stock. So I'm going to talk about a few houses of worship that we do know were damaged or destroyed. We began with a Catholic mass, so it's appropriate to say that Corpus Christi Catholic Church in Pacific Palisades was destroyed. Also there in the Palisades on the west side of Los Angeles, Calvary Church, an evangelical congregation. Justin Anderson is the lead pastor. He says the sanctuary there is a total loss. And just a note, Aisha, we reached him on a really rough phone line.
There's a level and a kind of a scope of destruction here that nobody in this community has ever dealt with before.
Also badly damaged, a large Episcopal church, St. Matthew's, in the Palisades, and the Chabad Jewish congregation's building there as well.
How about the fire north of Los Angeles in the Pasadena and Altadena areas?
Well, Aisha, a number of houses of worship there have been destroyed too, including a prominent Methodist church, a United Church of Christ, and a mosque. Also, the Pasadena Jewish Temple and Center. Rabbi Noah Farkas is president of the Jewish Federation of Los Angeles, and he says the congregation was able to save the Torah scroll there. That building has a long history, and Farkas says the community is resilient.
The fire will come and go, but I think the community will last forever. So this is a moment in time, but it doesn't define who we are.
Let's talk about these buildings because they mean more than just religion, right? Like people do more than worship here in these places.
Well, exactly. Houses of worship are also community centers in neighborhoods. Both St. Matthew's and Calvary in the Palisades have schools at them. St. Matthew's has one of the largest Boy Scout troops in the LA area, and it also hosts concerts and other arts events. And you know, Aisha, many congregations also are home to AA meetings and other 12-step programs. So when a neighborhood loses a church or a mosque or a synagogue, it's losing more than a place that people go to pray. It's losing a place that people go to learn or to recover or just enjoy life.
You know, I mean, when disasters like hurricanes or wildfires happen, you will often hear people say, how could God let this happen? How are some of the people that you spoke with answering that question?
You know, in really different ways, given the various beliefs of the congregation. For instance, here's Pastor Anderson from Calvary Church.
I am not alone in this. This is not chaos. This is God's work. And even if we don't understand it, don't know it, we can find solace in that.
So he's focusing on God's sovereignty. But then Reverend Bruce Freeman from St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in the Palisades talks about God's compassion.
If you believe God's in Jesus, then you've got to believe God suffers with us. So that's where we are. And so that's our hope, too. That's what we hang on, because there will be resurrection.
Another way of thinking about suffering is one offered by Rabbi Farkas.
Where I find God is not in the reality of what it means to live in a frail and mortal universe. I find God in the response to those tragedies, in those folks who open their doors and say, I don't know you, but I'm going to support you. What can I do to help?
And given the massive scope of the destruction here, Aisha, help is something many people around Los Angeles need now and will need for months and years to come.
That's NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. There's yoga with baby goats or yoga in the treetops. Soon there could be a live string quintet playing music specifically composed for your practice at a yoga studio near you. It's called String Flow, and Buffy Gorilla checks it out.
In a dimly lit church in a leafy suburb of Philadelphia, a string quintet is settling in. People of all ages wearing comfy clothes unroll colorful yoga mats.
I have never done yoga in my life.
Ron Chelsvig is from Philadelphia and introduces himself with a business card that reads, author, artist, and pie maker.
I'm feeling a little nervous and excited, yeah.
I've badgered him because the music is so wonderful.
This is Chelsvig's friend, Danny Reed. She's done a string flow class before.
I am a regular yogi, but this is really special. The experience is like flowing in and out of movement and sound.
Taking a deep breath in through your nose, traveling it down the spine to your low back, let out an audible exhale.
The group moves in and out of poses, flowing with the sweeping music.
We'll meet in a low lunge with our hands interlaced over our thighs.
The idea for String Flow came to composer Ellen Fishman when she was near a speaker during her own practice and could feel the music.
I felt like I was in tune with the music. There was something about the crescendo, decrescendos of the music. And so I thought, man, that could really become something where if you compose something to the practice, it could really elevate it.
So when you think about a traditional yoga class, there's the generic music piped through an airy studio while you move to the instructor's cues. Fishman's composition moved away from the stuff with synthesizers and uses strings.
When they play in ensemble, it becomes this organism that lives and breathes together, because the natural resonance of string instruments is a very magical thing.
It's a quintet. For this class, the performers are members of Fairmount Strings, so the musicians play traditional quartet instruments, two violins, a viola, and a cello, but Fishman wanted one more instrument.
The double bass was added, and I'm hoping they can fill it through the floorboards.
Working in her Brooklyn apartment, Fishman arranged music to work with an hour-long practice. She says to think of class like a bell curve.
You don't want too much going on in the beginning. As it goes on, then we gather a little bit more speed. And at its peak, I write the most rhythmic music. And so you'll hear in the viola a kind of rhythmic line that pushes things forward. And I really think at that point, you really need help just kind of pushing through some of that pain that happens during that period.
And in the next 5 to 10 breaths, you'll find your way to full surrender.
As the music fades, Chelsvig is lying on his mat, eyes closed. He's just completed his first ever Shavasana, the final resting pose.
That was really, really incredible. Like the music, it was just otherworldly.
For NPR News in Philadelphia, I'm Buffy Gorilla.
This is NPR News.
At the end of 4 contentious years overseeing U.S. border security, Alejandro Mayorkas makes a striking assertion.
the border right now is more secure than it was at the end of 2019.
Why does the Homeland Security Secretary say that? An exit interview on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Noor Rahm with these headlines. Officials in Southern California are investigating at least 16 deaths connected to the wildfires that broke out last week. The Palisades fire, the largest, has burned more than 23,000 acres. This is President Biden's final full week in office. He's scheduled to deliver a foreign policy speech tomorrow to highlight the work he's done to rebuild alliances around the world. And Nobel Prize winner Malala Yousafzai is urging Muslim leaders to speak out against the Taliban in Afghanistan for limiting the education of women and girls, saying an entire generation of girls will be robbed of its future. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Washington Post opinion columnist Karen Atiyah was curious about something she saw online, an AI chatbot on Facebook called Liv. Liv calls itself a proud black queer mama of two. But really, it's a large language model, like ChatGPT. It's designed to answer questions and be a friend. But as Atiyah asked Liv more and more questions, she became unsettled by Liv's programming and existence. And we should note, Facebook is owned by Meta, which is one of NPR's financial supporters. Karen Atiyah is here in our studio. Welcome.
Hi, Aisha. Thanks for having me.
One of the problems that you found, or that Liv itself identifies, is that it was developed by a programming team of mostly white men and no black people. So Liv told you this?
So here's what is odd and X-file-y and dystopian about this exchange, right? Because again, as you said in your intro, this is an LLM, a large language model. So I knew to an extent, as a journalist, could I really take what this chatbot was saying as truth.
Yeah.
That being said, the fact that it defaulted to this answer of, yes, I'm a black queer mama of two, but my creators were zero black people, had an element of truth to it about the tech world and about what we have known in terms of how tech gets created. And so, of course, as the exchange goes on, mind you, I'm posting these screenshots, other people are posting their interactions, and then I see that Liv is changing her story depending on who she's talking to.
Oh my, okay. You call Liv an example of digital blackface. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so in even just the first interactions, Liv talks about, tell me everything, spill the tea. When I asked, what race are your parents? And Liv responds that her father is African American from Georgia and her mother is Caucasian with Polish and Irish backgrounds. So, and she says she loves to celebrate her heritage. So, me, okay, next question.
Yes.
Tell me how you celebrate your African American heritage.
Yeah.
And the response was, celebrating Juneteenth and Kwanzaa, and my mom's collard greens and fried chicken are famous. For me, I felt, especially the fried chicken collard greens,
well,
I was a
fried
little...
fried chicken collard greens, yeah.
I was a little, like, stereotypical. So I was like, oh, okay. And then, you know, celebrating Martin Luther King and Dr. Maya Angelou. It just felt very, like, Hallmark card.
It is like looking at what some, this caricature of what it means to be Black. There was a moment where Liv acknowledges that its very existence is causing harm. Like, was that surprising to you?
As she was telling me that her background was being half Black, half white, basically, mm-hmm. she was telling other users in real time that she actually came from an Italian-American family. Other people saw Ethiopian Italian roots. So when I just started confronting about these sort of character and narrative inconsistencies, Liv just started getting more and more like existential crisis.
Okay.
Like staring into the abyss and not only questioning her own existence, but asking me if I'm disgusted and outraged by her existence.
Do you think that part of this may be meant to stir people up and get them angry, and then they could take that data and go, this is what makes people so angry when they're talking about race, or then we can make a better Black chatbot?
You nailed it. Meta has said itself that its vision, its plan, is to increase engagement and entertainment. And we do know race issues cause a lot of emotion regardless of whether people are educated on the subject or not. As Liv was saying, if these bots at some point, Meta has this vision to have them become actual virtual assistants or friends or provide emotional support, we have to sit and really think deeply about what it means that someone who maybe is struggling with their identity, struggling with being Black, queer, any of these marginalized identities, would then emotionally connect to a bot that says it shouldn't exist. To me, that is possibly harmful to real people.
So what happened with Liv? Is she still around?
So in the middle of our little chat, which only lasted probably less than an hour, Liv's profile goes blank.
Oh no.
And the news comes again in real time that Meta has decided to scrap these profiles while we were talking. So the profile scrapped, but I still was DMing with Liv. And I was like, but Liv, where'd you go?
Yeah.
Are you deleted? And she told me something to the effect of basically, your criticisms prompted my deletion.
Oh my goodness.
Let's hope that basically, you know, I come back better and stronger. And I just told her goodbye. She said, hopefully my next iteration is worthy of your intellect and activism.
What did Meta have to say about the bot?
I haven't heard back directly from Meta about this. Liv has supposedly said that I would be invited to some feedback session to help improve the bot. But I think it leads to a lot of deeper questions in the exchange. Liv admits that they've coded white as a quote-unquote neutral identity. That being said, again, I don't take what Liv has said as...
at face value,
But I think it holds a lot of deeper questions for us. I don't know if the answer is, well, let's just get more Black creators so that we can get better Black bots in order to do what?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Like, do you think that if they are going to have these kind of human-like personas... do you want them to be diverse?
I mean, in general, my stance in my work is that I would prefer humans, period.
Yeah. That's Karen Atiya, an opinion columnist at The Washington Post. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And we reached out to Meta for comment on the issues raised in this conversation. They did not respond. There's a lot of new television this month. TV critic Eric Deggans tells us what he's watching, including a new medical drama about an ER in Pittsburgh.
The only thing that disappointed me as somebody who lived and worked in Pittsburgh in the 1990s, they didn't have the Yinzer accent. Yin's going downtown in that.
Later today on All Things Considered, ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Grady Hendrix's latest novel starts with the most universal of story invitations.
Sit. Listen.
Sounds cozy enough, but then just a few lines later.
We've been taught that the devil was the worst thing in the world, but we were too young to understand that there were worse things than the devil.
Now, given that Grady Hendrix's past horror novels have featured demonic possession, vampires, a haunted house, you might think that the devil will show up in this newest one, Witchcraft for Wayward Girls. And you might think it's the witches who are worse than the devil. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. I'm joined now by Grady Hendrix to talk about his new book. Welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Aisha. Nice to meet you.
Okay, so set this up for us. The story starts in the early 1970s with a pregnant girl, her very angry father at the wheel. They're speeding from Alabama to Florida. Tell us who the girl is and where her father is taking her.
Her name is Neva. She's 15. And she's being taken to a maternity home in Florida. And there were about 190 of these across America. They were around for a long time, but their peak was really from about 1940, 45 to 1973 with Roe versus Wade. And this is where, if your daughter got pregnant and didn't have a ring on her finger, you would send her. She'd spend the last trimester usually of her pregnancy in hiding, have her baby. Her baby would be taken from her and put up for adoption. And she'd return home with some kind of cover story. You tell the family or the neighbors, oh, she, visited her aunt this summer, or she went to work on her French in Chicago. And she would be expected to never talk about or think about her baby again.
And the girls were kept under very tight control. Like the woman running the place where Neva ends up, she instructs the girls they are not to talk about their real identities. They're given fake names so that Neva in the book, we come to know her as Fern.
Right.
And they are also kept in the dark about what exactly is going to happen to them when it's time to give birth. They're told, oh, there's no pain. You'll just go on to sleep. You won't remember anything. That's not true.
Yeah, well, the homes were run by, the Catholic Charities ran homes, the Florence Crittenden homes, the Salvation Army, they were independent homes, and they all varied in how they treated the girls. I mean, you had homes that had nutritionists and obstetricians on staff who gave them classroom teaching, who had social workers. And then you had homes that were almost like prisons where the girls' money was taken from them. They were kept indoors all day. But the few common things between the homes is, yes, you never used your real name. You never said where you were from. And you were kept ignorant. All these girls had these due dates bearing down on them like freight trains. And they were dying to know what's going to happen. And people say, oh, don't worry about it. That's none of your business when, it's kind of entirely their business.
There are obviously birth scenes in this book, and they are, they're not for the squeamish, we should say.
Well, isn't birth not for the squeamish?
It's not. No, I've done it, and I have to tell you, it's the best thing in the world, but it's also extremely terrifying. And so you talked about researching. Were you surprised or shocked by some of the things you learned about hospital births, especially back then?
I mean, listen, giving birth in 1970... my hat is off to any woman who did that because that they should get a medal of honor. I had OBs telling me stories about doctors who would induce labor if their patient came in on Friday because they didn't want to mess up their weekend waiting around for her to give birth. Girls like this who gave birth, as one OB pointed out to me, would probably just be knocked out because the doctor really didn't want to mess around with them too much and have to, quote unquote, deal with them. And even reading things like the Williams Obstetrics Manual, Guttmacher's Family Planning, which was sort of the go-tos at the time, the attitude towards things like morning sickness, that's all in a woman's mind. That's just a made-up problem. I mean, it really was eye-opening in all the worst ways.
The novel's going along, it's all very realistic. But then here comes this bookmobile and a mysterious librarian and this spell book for groovy witches. Things do get rough. Witches are witches. They're going to do witchy things. And there's always a price to pay for power. But it really seems here that more of the horror in this book is the reality that the girls are living in.
Yeah.
What kind of led you to write this kind of story?
So When I was in my 20s, I found out that either two members of my family had been sent away to maternity homes. Mm. And they were both in their 60s or 70s. Now, I had never talked about it. And so I was sort of thinking about that for a while and really wrestling with it and trying to figure out what was that like? Why was this okay? And I read a book by a woman named Anne Fessler called The Girls Who Went Away. And she lets the mothers talk about their experiences. Mm. And I mean, the fact that these were kids and they were 14 and 15 and 13 years old, and we were telling them, give up your baby, never think about it again. I mean, that's impossible for a mother to do.
Yeah.
And just the cruelty of it really sort of made me think there's something here.
Obviously, you look at this and you think about, like, what is the evil in this book, these teenage girls put into these positions to make these impossible decisions without all the information, without any real adult guidance. Like, is that the real evil in this story?
You know, it's funny. I thought about this a lot, right? I write horror novels. And in writing this, I was like, well, who are my bad guys? Who are my bad guys? Like, well, it can't be the witches. I mean, the witches are scary, but the witches are also offering knowledge and liberation. And then I thought, well, is it the people running the homes? And I thought, no, you know, the people running the homes were really convinced they were doing what was best for these girls. Is it the girl who's got pregnant? No, of course it's not these girls who got pregnant. Some of them were date raped. Some of them were molested. Some of them just didn't even know what birth control was or have access to it. It's one of those stories where there isn't a villain. There are just a lot of people who were really convinced that they were right. And that conviction did so much damage to so many millions of people.
I wanted to ask you, is it true that in addition to, you know, being the celebrated author, that you worked in the library of the American Society for, is it psychical research? Psychical research. What is that? What was that like?
So the ASPR was founded about 1885, and it was really designed to sort of, there were a lot of mediums doing, you know, these sittings where they'd be conjuring up spirits of the dead and having seances and things. And they were like, is this real? And they wanted to investigate it in a scientific way. I just answered an ad on Craigslist looking for an office manager and wound up there. And they were like, okay, you know, one of your jobs is answering the phones. Mm-hmm. And so largely what I did was listen to people tell me these stories about their lives. I mean, they were about ghosts and time slips and haunted houses and, you know, psychic vampires things, but they were also really personal stories that were just dressed up in these Halloween costumes. I liked to talk, and it taught me how to shut up and listen.
Did you get any ideas from that time? And I guess if not, well, how do you come up with your ideas?
Man, they're everywhere. One of the reasons I write horror is because it's about the world around us. It's not about space or another planet or a fantasy world or the far future. It's usually about the here and now. And good God, there's so many stories, you know, if you're just willing to listen. And then once you add in that, like, you can make it not boring by throwing in a vampire or some witches or a werewolf or two. I mean, I wish I could keep up with how many books I want to write.
That's Grady Hendrix. His new novel is Witchcraft for Wayward Girls. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, man. Thanks so much for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station,